Indonesia or New Guinea or China. It was
everywhere.
Universal. Yeah. The Port Moresby massacre, you know, they won in the Andaman Islands. They took what they thought were, they were having food problems there, and so they took 200 useless mouths, put them on a ship, took them out to the ocean, and pushed them off. Yeah. Like, what would possess you to do that? I don't know.
Well, we had some nasty stories from the Philippines, too, the Balandiga.
Yes.
And
the massacres on Samar.
Right. Oh, yeah, we had concentration camps.
Oh, yeah. And yes.
A lot of that. Waterboarding. A bold comment about human nature.
Yeah.
I just think
humans are awful.
Something really bad in humans comes out, and it's not, you know, linked to any one culture.
It was, I think it's Douglas MacArthur's dad testified, and it was in before Congress in the wake of the U.S. and putting down the insurrection in the Philippines, and he said, war brings out the ferocity in everyone. And I think you're right. That's exactly what, I think that's exactly the
sentiment. And then it's a question of leadership in Imperial Japan. You had a fascist government, a militaristic government, and government matters, and the political system matters.
Yeah, and there's not a lot of cases of people being punished for that kind of behavior, you know, it was permissive.
Right. So,
yes, sir.
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. I missed a lot of your... I had a conflicting... Mm-hmm. But I was going to address part of what Grace said about why Europe and not Asia. Mm-hmm. I wanted to make the point, I think, when I was working in the Congress, I worked for Henry Hyde for 6 years. There were, and he was with Tom Lantos, who knew a lot about the war in Europe. But Henry was in the Pacific, in the Philippines. And when we made his last trip to Asia in 2006, they threw over Ligayan Gulf, the American military plane, so he could see. He said, I was a 21-year-old skipper of a ship, and the Japanese shot my boat out from under me. But he always called Yamashita my nemesis. And on that trip, he went on and on about him and what happened in Manila and the Tiger of Malaya, right? And he said he sent all the Brits to the Burma Railway, right? And so he didn't think highly of him. And I think that actually impacted. He did agree, as the first Republican, to mark up a comfort woman resolution, H. Res. 759. There were other issues involved with that, but I think personal biography. Now, of course, Pappy Bush, President Bush, was shot down in the Pacific, too. The problem is that generation's gone, and there hasn't been the great focus, as you said, with museums, Hollywood movies, other ways. The American public, I say, learned their history from movies. I mean, we had Unbroken and a few, but not as many as about Europe. And also on that trip, I mean, he didn't go down, but he told us we went down to the embassy in Manila, and they have the room in there where the Yamashita was tried in the embassy. And he had his staff. He was in a wheelchair, he went to the cemetery in Metley, but he said you should all go down and see that. So that was one point I went, and that whole generation. My uncle was a medic in the Philippines. And he brought out the emaciated POWs, and he told me before he died, he had to sign a promise with the U.S. military not to discuss the condition of the POWs with the public. In fact, they were going to interview him, the Library of Congress, for Living History, but he died right before they could. They were trying to set that up. I don't think he had the paper anymore. I asked his kids to look for it, but you can see when Eisenhower, when they took the camps in Europe, Eisenhower sent two cables back to General Marshall. He said, send the members of Congress, send the press. He said, I have seen what happened, and I fear that in the future there will be people who will minimize this, so I want it on the record. MacArthur, on the other hand, by having people, you know, sign these agreements not to disclose, there was a whole different approach. So those are two things I'd say. Well, three things. One, there's not as much coverage. Second, the generation that fought in the Pacific has died. They told oral history, but they're gone, like Henry Hyde and my uncle. And the third thing is the different approach between General Eisenhower and General MacArthur on how to address the issue right after the war.
Well, why did MacArthur order that?
I think they decide. I mean, you know, I just was in Nuremberg 2 weeks ago. I saw the room 600 in the Palace of Justice where the trials were. I think the impression one gets, and the ashes also, like Hitler, the KGB, our guide told us, they found a piece of skull and something. They know that Hitler did shoot himself, but they said the KGB took him off, and he was in some base in Poland for a number of years, and then when the Cold War was ending, the KGB burned his body, right? That's what they say. But when they executed Tojo and the other people, they sent them to a crematorium in Yokohama, and they were burned there, but somebody bribed or something. The ashes were all supposed to be thrown in Tokyo Bay, so there would be no, just like Hitler, they didn't want. And people, right-wing princes or somebody, bribed the crematorium, and they got the ashes and took them to that Buddhist temple up in the mountain.
There's some in the mountain, and there's some in Yasukuni, and some went out.
Yeah, and Yasukuni too.
Went out to the bay. That's so they say. who the heck knows?
But I think MacArthur thought we need to keep the emperor system so we don't have like an Iraq, an insurgency. You know, the thing is, you break it, you own it. As Colin Powell said, it wasn't defeating Saddam was the easy part. Then you had this insurgency. So they kept the emperor and the police force and everything and didn't rock the boat in Japan, and the Cold War came along. Whereas in Germany, I guess it was so horrendous, and maybe because it was Europe, I don't know why, but they did much more denazification than they
did. Japan was in ruins, and he needed to not just pacify, but he had to rebuild, he had to feed these people. And so if the American people got all the POW stories, they would not send a thing over. I don't know.
Yeah, but whatever the motive was.
Or the Allied powers would have stronger voices toward his policy, in Asia.
But look at the ramifications for today.
Yeah.
I mean, the Yasukuni Shrine is controversial today. The fact there are tensions between Japan, Korea, China regarding the so-called comfort women.
Yeah.
I mean, all you know,
and
this is
the
a lie.
Japanese government spending a lot of money on damping the comfort women, damping the history, giving a lot of money to the Japanese American community to accentuate the internment of the Japanese, and to accentuate the bombing of Hiroshima. So, you know, but there's not enough on the other side, and then part of the ticket to get Japanese funding is not to criticize Japan.
Yeah.
Yes.
What is the recent day Filipinos' attitude towards Japan? Because, you know, recently the President Duterte just allowed the Japanese to destroy the statue of the
comfort
women
in front of the Bay View,
and 20 years ago the Filipinos kicked out the United States out of the Subic Bay. So it is we have a very conflicting information. And then on my Korean experience during the 60s and 70s, when we had the agreement with Japan, then at the time we needed money to revive our economy. And then the government want to keep our voices low. But after that, it is exploded. So I'm wondering whether the Filipinos haven't been lowering their voices right now, and there is a possibility their voices may explode out, or they may have a good impressions or good friendship with Japanese. So I wonder what's the current address of the Filipinos?
There's a very active group of survivors, Battle of Manila survivors. They have an organization. They put on events. They funded books in the Philippines in the past and things like that. So they really carry, there are statues like the one in Intramuros. There's also one at De La Salle College on Taft Avenue, which is where another one of the big massacres took place. So they're doing a lot to continue to keep the spotlight on what happened. That's an older generation, though. You know, these were A lot of them were the children during the battle and survived. You know, their board of directors has you know, a lot of survivors from the Battle of Manila who were 5, 10 years old at that time. And now what they're actually starting to do is bring on some of the children of survivors as well. So they are trying to keep programming going and media attention going to highlight this issue. The Philippines also is, you know, it's a huge young population, and getting them engaged in history is like it is in the United States. It's really difficult. And I think that's part of what they're up to as well. The Japanese have they spent a lot of money in the Philippines, a lot of money on infrastructure and things like that. And from folks I've talked to, you know, that there's been an effort, I think, over the years to sort of blame more the Battle of Manila on the American artillery than as much on what happened by the Japanese. There's some truth to that, too. I mean, you can't fire 42,000 artillery shells into a 14-square-mile area and not cause lots of deaths and lots of destruction. A lot of the targets were aimed, you know, at buildings and things like that where the Japanese were. The Japanese did sweep through neighborhoods and set them on fire using incendiary squads and whatnot. So, but there has been this battle that has gone on to sort of shape the narrative of what happened there all these years later. And it's something that's still going on even today. I mean, as Mindy talked about, there's been a, in front of the Bayview Hotel, which is where many of the sexual assaults occurred in Manila. It's still a hotel today. It's a nice hotel right there on the bay, and it was a statue put up earlier this year to remember those who were victims of them. And it was about a week later, I believe, it was taken down.
Recently, it was the same day that Moon and Kim Jong Un met on April 29th. That evening, that day, in the middle of the night in Manila, they literally ripped the statue out. So the statue was around for about 6 months. But it was, as you said, it was facing the Bayview Hotel.
I was at a conference this weekend in San Francisco.
Was the statue facing to the Bayview?
Yeah, I was at a conference on World War II in the Philippines, and there were a bunch of folks were over from Manila, and so I was asking for an update on it all, and they said essentially the statue is now being kept in a public works yard in Manila, so they're not even, the government hasn't even given it back to the organization that put it out there. But they're claiming that, the government's claim is that there's about to be some infrastructure work done there on, and that it was in the way of that.
Yeah.
So there's,
They literally ripped it out. And it was clearly pandering to Japan. But I think, I was in the Philippines in 2012, and the way the monuments, particularly on Bataan, it was not particularly well maintained. But there seems to have been more of a push to get more statues, more monuments. The Bataan Death March markers have been restored. There seems to be a revival of interest.
The Corregidor is, you know,
Corregidor fanning of anti-Japanese.
Right.
Now. Flames, and that's been true way before Duterte.
Yeah.
And then Marcos even invited the war criminals back.
Yeah.
As part of this forgiveness.
On Corregidor, there's a big memorial to the Japanese. There's a Shinto shrine, and
there's a kamikaze. Malenta tunnel too, for that matter.
Yeah. And there's a kamikaze thing.
Is kamikaze memorial?
Well, there's some guy who's really into a kamikaze. Because the original kamikazes came from the Philippines. So that area, I think.
Also remember that the Japanese parliament responded by making it illegal for the country to go to war, knowing the problems and atrocities that happened in the 40s around the
I think the restoration of the relations between Japan and the Philippines started with the approval of the Garcia Ono Reparation Bill, and it came into law when Japan as an obligatory gestures donated or gave away several hundred million dollars for the reparations and the construction of damaged land to Manila and other countries.
Just to wrap up for the both of you, so how should the Battle of Manila be remembered, and what is how do we move forward?
Yeah. No, I mean, I think it's important we do that. I mean, that's why I wanted to write the book. I was amazed when I started researching this that there had been no real big American study looking at this battle, despite the ferocity, despite the incredible loss of life, about it. And so, I mean, I was really stunned by that.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing.
It really is, particularly considering that, you know, the U.S., the long historical connection between America and the Philippines, you know, from the development of Manila, as a, you know, from the Spanish-American War, the development of the city, you know, it's really the sort of a ground zero of the American experience in World War II. So I was stunned by that, and that's why I wanted to take the project on. I think groups like the Memorare and Manila are doing the absolute right thing. You know, they are. They actually sent out, and this is one of the in the 1990s. They published all these ads in major Manila newspapers like the Inquirer, and said, you know, did you or your family members were they lost? What happened to them during the Battle of Manila? And hundreds of people wrote in. And those archives are actually there in Makati City at the Ayala Museum, and they're open to researchers. I spent several days going through reading them all, and so they've done a lot to try to remember that. And I think it's so important going forward that people do. I mean, this was a level of warfare, a level of violence that is just. Yes, sir.
I'm wondering whether Quezon's appointment of MacArthur as the field marshal for the defense of the Philippines, was it a political move, or because there were, I think, well, the present situation was there was a situation between Eisenhower and MacArthur for preparing the Philippines for the defense of the Philippines?
I didn't quite follow your question there. I'm sorry, was it?
Understand the link between Quezon's appointment
of MacArthur. MacArthur. Yeah, 1935.
Was that a political move on the part of Quezon, or Quezon was already aware that MacArthur had on hand a draft of the defense of the Philippines?
Well, MacArthur was coming to the end of his time as the chairman of the Joint Chiefs,
and Chief of Staff,
yeah, and so I mean, he was kind of sort of wrapping up there, and Quezon was looking. I mean, Quezon was advocating heavily for the independence of the Philippines and looking as a way to build the military at that time. Yeah, I don't think it was any secret that military tensions were really high, even from the end of World War One onward. I mean, you got American analysts predicting, as you know, literally smoke still settling at the end of World War One, that someday we're going to go to war with the Japanese, and the Philippines, as you know, as an American colony right there in the region, would be the front lines of that. And so I don't think there's any doubt that Quezon was looking to build up his military so that the islands could be defensible. And that's what he, when he went to approach MacArthur, he asked, you know, do you think we can make the islands defensible? And of course MacArthur's response was, of course, as long as you have the resources.
And
he was, you know, paid handsomely for it. So I think there was, you know, no doubt MacArthur, you know, brought a star power to it. He brought the ability, you know, and the connections to be able to lobby the U.S. Congress for the resources they needed, things of that nature. I mean, you know, he brought that, you know, that access to the American power establishment that the Philippines would need during that time. So I think, yeah, there's no doubt about it, a huge political element to it. But I think there was an ultimate legitimate military purpose, which was, how do we, if we are going to be independent, and the U.S. has told us that we're going to get our independence, how do we make ourselves secure?
Yeah, mm-hmm. I would underscore that also. You know, we passed an act in 1934 promising the Philippines independence in 10 years. And by any astute politician, Quezon was clearly in that category. If you're looking around the world at the end of the 1930s and you're going to be offered independence, you know, it's like, you know, like the dependent niece being turned loose into, you know, the horrors of a big city at night, you know. It's a very rough neighborhood, you know. So he recognized. Now, he had, I think, at least I would argue, that he also, and this is controversial, I admit, is that Quezon was farsighted to realize that, you know, the Philippines absolutely going it alone facing the Japanese was not a very promising prospect or whatever here. So part of building up the Philippine defenses, particularly the Philippine Army, was to be able to provide a defense effort to sustain some residual American bases, to keep the Americans tied into the Philippines so that
you'd had the deterrent effect against the Japanese of, you know, well, if you want to come up and police up the Philippines, you're going to have to take on the Americans also.
Yeah.
And MacArthur, you know, we can go another 2 hours about MacArthur's faults, but one thing about MacArthur that certainly strikes me is that he genuinely respected Asians. He, you know, and they were acutely conscious about the difference between somebody who had some basic respect for them and someone who was just, you know, a thoroughbred racist or whatever here. And MacArthur showed that by most expatriate Americans living in Manila or whatever here, when the work day was over, they went off with the other expats to socialize. He socialized with the Filipinos.
Yeah, I mean, they had in Manila at that time, I mean, you had, you know, essentially whites-only golf courses and things like that. And I mean, it was very much like it was in the United States at that time in the South, where you had sort of this two split sides. You had golf clubs and things like that for where the Americans played and those for the Philippines. And MacArthur didn't see that color line. And I think that was very much appreciated. In fact, he caught grief. MacArthur caught grief, actually, from some of the other officers and for that. But that's just that. You know, he wholly embraced it, wholly embraced the Filipinos.
But the things did not work out well, as the test of 41-42 showed. And there's a lot of blame to go around. Mm. MacArthur certainly bears a substantial part of it. But there's blame on the Filipino side not financing, supporting the effort, on the U.S. side for not supporting the effort with arms and equipment. One of the problems with the Philippine Army was that their equipment was abysmal.
Yeah. You know,
World War One.
The scouts had first class equipment or whatever here. The Philippine Army had leftovers from World War One. In fact, they were given this bastardized British rifle that was so bad the extractor didn't work. So you'd fire around and the bullet would not eject. And and they were running around carrying around a rammer to knock. It's like having a musket.
Yeah.
You know, to ram to fire the next round or whatever. That's what kind of weaponry that they were operating with.
That's awful. Well, they were totally unprepared in so many ways. And a lot of the troops that were being rushed in 1941 were sent, put on the boat untrained. So these guys, like I have one former POW who's actually still alive, said he didn't fire a rifle. He was Army Air Corps, and they took them to be infantry on baton, but he hadn't fired a rifle until he went to baton. Right. Mm-hmm. He learned quickly.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Very quickly. Any more questions? Yes.
There was like sort of recorded the internal debate before Pearl Harbor within the Japanese government over how to respond to the sanctions by the U.S. And there was, if that had led to the Japanese only attacking the Philippines, what do you think the United States response would have been there?
I think what you mean is, what if the Japanese had not attacked the Philippines? They'd gone after the British and the Dutch? Because that was a huge fear among the Americans, that the Japanese would bypass the Philippines and wake any American possession and simply go after the European colonial holdings. And there was severe doubt whether the American public could be roused to go to war against Japan over European colonial holdings. And this was certainly something in Washington that was, they felt that right down to the end. But the Japanese thought that the Philippines, the way it strategically were, it's sitting right in the lines of communication in the resource area, that they simply cannot abide letting the Americans sit there and then coming into the war later and cutting them off.
Very few Americans know that when the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor, they also bombed the Philippines and Wake and Guam and Malaya and Shanghai and Bangkok. Did I miss something? Singapore?
No, that's a good enough list.
Yeah. Okay. There's a lot of places.
A lot of places.
Indonesia.
Yeah. They didn't bomb Indonesia that day.
Not that day.
Not that day. I'm talking about the same day. 24 hours.
Same 24 hours.
Yeah. You had a question.
Yes, I have two questions. First of all, I'd like to ask some implications by issuing Tragedy in Manila, the book title, because in Japan 1949, there was a book named The Bells of Nagasaki. But soon after that, the book, Tragedy in Manila, issued. So are there any implications or intentions of the United States government or people?
Which book are you talking about from 1949?
Tragedy in Manila. I don't know the certain translation in English.
Yeah.
It's a Japanese book about the Manila.
Oh, I see.
No, I don't know. I don't know. I actually don't know about this book.
Well, no. I mean, there was an early book done called Terror in the Manila. That was done in within a few years afterwards, and that was actually done by a Filipino historian, and in fact, it was re-released. The book was a sort of an early effort to gather survivor accounts, if you will, and they had different some of the major atrocities and voices represented there, and so it was really an early effort to get it on. It was by a guy named Perez de Oliguer, I think. He was of Filipino of Spanish ancestry, and the book was long went out of print and whatnot, and then it was re-released. The Memorare got the rights to it and re-released it in the Philippines with a new introduction a number of years ago, probably 10 years ago, 15 years ago, for its value and the fact that he had gathered these accounts from people soon thereafter and put them all together, to release it. But so that was actually more, it wasn't a U.S. push for that. It organically came out of the Philippines in the wake of that. So you have to remember, Manila was a mess for many, many years afterwards. Intramuros, the walled city, just stayed empty, barren, blasted all the way up into the 1970s. So, it really took a long time. In a lot of ways, Manila never really recovered. You go south of Manila to where Makati is, and that's where all the big glass and concrete high-rises are, and the department stores and banks and everything, and you go kind of around downtown Manila, and it's still, kind of a battered city, particularly compared to the way it was when it was the Pearl of the Orient, when there was so much attention put into developing it and whatnot. So, it still, in many ways, shows those scars of the battle even today.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. The second question is okay?
Yes, of course.
Thank you. And the second question is, let me confirm the meaning of the title. Mm-hmm. What is Rampage? Your focus on what?
The Rampage is about the rampage that the Japanese troops did during the Battle of Manila.
So you think that second question is who did Rampage in your story?
The Japanese Marines who were in Manila at that time are the ones who went on a rampage to and killed the civilians. I will tell you, it actually was not my title idea for the book. We were really struggling with a lot of things to come up with titles, and so my editor had said, go back through the book, find some snippet from a quote that we could use to do, and so I've gone through and I put together two pages of little quotes from different diaries and things like that, and it's a Friday night about 8 o'clock, and my editor was going through one of the drafts of the manuscript, and he calls me at home and he says, I've got it, Rampage. And I was like,
because that's
I was like, and he said, he's like, that's exactly what this is, and I was like, that's perfect,
means going crazy. Wild,
yeah, going wild, going crazy, yeah, yeah.
What's the butt? I'm curious what you see as butt, because to us that is the perfect word.
Mm-hmm. Oh, really?
Yes. What did you? How would you perceive it?
Yes, there are two meanings for me. First is you think that just Japanese troops, but you said you wrote Yamashita. General Yamashita name on the book, so I'm not sure the Rampage and his name.
Well, he was the overall commander of the army forces in the Philippines, and so Yeah, and MacArthur, yeah. So, and some of that is purely because you have to, in a subtitle, get other pieces of information out there that will show up in Google Trends.
Yeah, because MacArthur
yeah. That'll show up.
Who was involved?
Yeah. I mean, there's an art to naming and titling and subtitling books to sort of communicate, you know, is it fiction, is it nonfiction? Well, if it's nonfiction, what part of, you know, is it the European theater? Is it the is the Pacific theater? Is it? So all of that kind of factors in. So I wasn't a huge fan of the subtitle, but as my editor walked me through the logistics, the sort of how Google interprets queries and how this would match
That's
up with the search, you know, parameters, I was like, that makes sense.
And I was worried when I put the title in that people would not know when the Battle of Manila was.
Yeah, was this the one in the 1890s?
Or the insurrection.
Yeah.
So I put in the date.
Yeah.
Just to be sure that they knew it was kind of like World War II,
yeah.
if they even knew.
Seriously. Like when Lincoln was president.
Yeah, it's possible. Who knew?
In Hongo Day.
Yes, I know. Because, yes, thank you so much for your kindness. And, yes, I just think that General Yamashita mm-hmm. did not want to keep on battling with the United States at the time. But he was a general,
yeah.
so
he allowed it.
Well, he knew that going to the Philippines was essentially a death sentence. I mean, he knew that he was being sent to, I think one of the words he said to one of his subordinates was, well, I guess it's my turn to die then. And that he was being sent down there to try to do the impossible, which was to slow down and stop the Americans. And so, and he had resigned himself to that. I mean, he was a career soldier. He was a professional, and this was the job that he had been tasked to handle. So he went and did, and you know, went and tried to lay out, I think, his vision for how he's going to slow down the Americans. How's it going to be? Is it going to be in an urban fight in Manila, or is it going to be, you know, using the landscape against them? One of the things he had done well in Singapore is he'd really used the land against the British. I mean, he had landed far up in the Malay Peninsula, and then, you know, they had, you know, used bicycles, which was pretty ingenious, to come down and easy to transport. They had, you know, taken food that they found and jeeps and trucks left behind by the British and sort of done it that way. And so in this case, he was looking at how he could use the landscape to his advantage too, which was, if he's outgunned and outmanned, you know, then you go out into the mountains and you make them have to come hunt you down. So I think that was his approach to it.
And it's very interesting for Japanese, because Japanese colors tends to focus on the individuals inner side of the Japanese troops.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, so Rampage is very awkward for Japanese,
mm-hmm.
but I'm very appreciate
happy
because
to.
It is the first time to knew the United States people's feelings and yes.
I hope you get the book.
Yes, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Any more questions? You can stay and ask more questions. I hope everyone will get the book, mm-hmm. become a member of Asia Policy Point, so you get a whole list of events. And if you know people who want the book, we'll have the book at the office and at a good discount. So thank you for coming.
Yeah, thank you guys. Yeah. And thanks, Richard, for that.
I want you to sign this one to me, and then I'm going to take a few of them and have you sign.
Thank you. Yeah.
Which will have. Oh, I think Ayumi has either signed two. I'm going to get him to sign. I'll be right back.
When you say discount, bottom line.
The bottom line, the book is
$36.95.
Is it?
You
want that? No,
that's
good.
Okay. This is a donation to Asia Policy.
Right.
You're right.
Got it.
So that's a good deal.
I like it.
Truth and goodness and light.
Truth and goodness and light. I love it.
So, and then.
And out, but how are you?
Yes. Right. And then Phil signed.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. I'll be right back.
Okay.
It's a pleasure to meet you.
Good to meet you as well.
Be in touch and very best of luck.
Thanks. Pleasure was mine today. Take care.
Yeah. Very good to meet you.
Oh, I'm sorry. I remember.
Yeah.
Thank you for your consideration.
Yeah.
Yeah. Could you just sign it to Al O'Neill?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm from Charleston, too.
Oh, really?
How long you been living there?
Yeah, 20 years. Yeah.
Oh, is that right?
So I'm actually over in Mount Pleasant, over in the old village.
Oh, is that?
Now,
yeah,
so,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. One of my cousins lives over there. He's also, his law office is over there, too. Dennis O'Neill.
Oh, he's my neighbor.
Oh, he is?
He's right around the corner from me. You're kidding
me. He's my first cousin. No, no.
Oh, we just sent him an invite to the book release party at our house in a couple weeks. He literally lives right around the corner from me. So that's too funny. Yeah. So.
He and I,
he's a voracious reader.
Yeah, I'm sure he is.
Yeah.
His father and my father were brothers.
Yeah.
They're both. In fact, his father died quite early. But yeah, well, say hi to Dennis for me. I guess he'd probably stay put, too. I know his sister, Patty, who's a lawyer over in West Ashley,
okay,
decided to go with her husband and mother-in-law to Hilton Head to evacuate from Florence.
Yeah.
You can believe that.
Oh, great.
Keep that.
That's too funny. I'll definitely tell him that.
Oh, yeah.
He was a big fan of Target Tokyo.
Oh, good.
So,
good. The only one I read on that was years and years ago, you probably know, A Torch to the Enemy by Martin Cade.
That's actually on on the March 10th, 1945 firebombing.
Yeah, yeah.
The Doolittle Raid was the one they did in 1942. So, yeah, that was the book by Target Tokyo. Was
oh,
that.
I see. That
yeah,
was
yeah.
about that. Okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
Very good to meet you.
It's great to meet you as well, Al. That's too funny. So.
That's amazing.
So who do we make this out to?
Oh, okay. Just that to Bobby and Gloria.
Okay, and are you Bobby?
Yeah.
Yeah, and Bobby and Gloria. So, yeah. And you were there during the Battle of Manila. So, wow.
And I think your comment about forgiveness as part of the Philippine psyche was really important about the way the Filipinos, I think, now look at the Japanese, because I think you're right. I'm sorry?
4 years.
Excuse me.
You know, I met President Quirino's son last weekend, and you know, he's the one who forgave all the Japanese. We were on a panel together.
He killed his wife and daughter?
Three of his kids, yeah.
And then, you know, the Japanese put a statue in Japan of him.
Yeah, in fact, wow, his grandson showed all these slides of going up there for it.
What did he think of that?
He thinks...
And what was the point of that? Thank you.
Was in the military, but now he works for...
Okay. All right, Bobby, there's that one. Do you need me to sign this one, too? Just a signature. Yep.
Congratulations.
Do you mean to do this one, Bobby and Gloria, too? You mean to do Gloria and Bobby for this one? Okay.
Eileen will be 3 in November. So they live out in
Illinois. Let's see, I did that one to Bobby and Gloria. So this one's Gloria and Bobby. Okay.
I know Naperville.
Everybody knows Naperville. I can't believe it.
My sister's college roommate used to live there.
Oh, my God. Well, that's where they've been living.
It's a big city, yeah.
It's not that. Yeah, it's about 150,000 people. Yeah.
For a suburb.
Yeah, for a suburb. That's true. I'm amazed at the number of people who know Naperville. But anyway, that's where they are. They're supposed to come back.
So you have Eileen. My daughter's Eileen.
Is that right?
My
granddaughter, Eileen, with an A.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
So anyway,
here's my
so
other card.
I definitely will.
So thank you. Yeah.
I do a lot.
Oh, and I've got. Hey, I've got a.
Congratulations.
Here you go.
You be your grandfather's ring.
Yeah. Thank you.
I don't need your card.
Congratulations. Oh, yeah. Thank you.
And did I give you both my cards?
I didn't know. I wanted to grab them though.
We'll see if we can.
Yeah, thank you.
Maybe come to the convention and speak. That
I'd would be
like the Institute closed May 31st. I haven't gotten new cards, but that's my email.
Do you know how to get a hold of Jay yet?
The post.
Somebody
card
said
exchanges.
I only heard. Who did I talk to? Yeah, I want to buy one. Of course I have to buy one of these because Henry Hyde.
Yes, and it's $20 cheap. A really good.
How much does this cost?
$20.
That's
been forgiving
it. Oh, thank you. Yes, thank you.
It costs us about a little less than 17 plus postage. And I'm not sure what the postage is.
Still is?
Yes. Yes. You want, can I give you my
silver stars?
Do I pay you, Mindy?
Yes. Or pay Ayumi outside. Or just pay me.
Cash
is fine.
Appreciate it.
Maybe he'll sign your name for it.
Exactly.
Do you live in Manila or what?
No, I went over there to research. I live in Charleston, South Carolina. So.
Where do you live?
In Charleston, South Carolina.
Oh, wow.
So,
it's a beautiful old town.
It's great. So I love it down there.
No, it's a great book. And you're a great writer.
You mean make this out to you? You mean make this out to you? Or just sign
it? Yeah, Dennis. Yeah, I guess so. As I said, Henry Hyde used to talk about Yamash, though, as his nemesis. So.
As a 21-year-old.
I wonder how much thought Yamashita gave to Henry Hyde during World War II.
Yeah. I think the guy was just a vicious SOB.
I'm sorry?
I think he was just a vicious SOB.
So do you teach?
Well, came with the job of being a general in the Japanese army
in
those days.
Yeah, I think you're sort of like, are you a vicious SOB?
You're right.
Checkbox.
I did.
But it's an interesting,
there's a paper I did in 2004 for the Institute of Korean American.